This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. So today we'd like to welcome Professor Patrick Condon to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Patrick Condon is a professor at UBC School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture. Professor Condon holds a Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Landscape Architecture from the University of Massachusetts. He started his career at the University of Minnesota before coming to UBC in 1992. So today we're going to talk a bit about Professor Condon's latest book called Sick City, which explores the issues of disease, race, inequality, and urban land. So just to start off, like I already introduced a little bit about you, but is there anything else you'd like to just add about yourself?
No, that's good.
Work you've done, okay. So talking about this book, I know you've written a few books in the past, and recently you've written Seven Rules. There was then Five Rules after that.
Yeah, they get less and less as I go along.
And yes, this book this time, there are no more rules. This one's just called Sick City. So what really prompted you to write this book?
Well, as you mentioned, I've written books in the past, and they've been largely about urban design, which is what I teach at UBC, in the sense of creating walkable neighborhoods that have diversity of building types, you know, and access to transit, and you know, different housing types for different family sizes and so forth, all the kind of kit of parts for the sustainable neighborhood, sustainable city, which is my urban design specialty, is sustainable cities. But increasingly, like everybody else in Vancouver, I've become more and more frustrated with the price of housing. That includes buying houses and also renting places, which students are more familiar with the problems of. Our housing prices here are only exceeded by the cost of housing globally in Hong Kong, you know, and only slightly less than Hong Kong at that. And the other tragedy here is that while high housing prices, like in a place like San Francisco, might make a little bit of sense because people there have substantially higher average salaries. And, you know, you would presume that housing costs, that was always the presumption, housing costs in high cost areas align with high average wages. And if you were in an area with low housing costs, it also meant that the average wage was low. But unfortunately for us in Vancouver, the price of housing is almost the highest in the world, and the average wages are the lowest in North America. So it doesn't make any sense. And my previous prescriptions on this one, which included adding density, you know, taking existing neighborhoods full of single family houses and put four dwelling units where there's a single family home, you know, you expect it to be cheaper. And to some extent that used to work until the 1990s and the turn of the century to the 21st. But as evidenced here, when you add density into a parcel, the only thing that really happens is the price of the land goes up. And when somebody has to buy or rent that house, there's no benefit that that additional density creates. So it was a bit of a life crisis for me, because the thing I'd been recommending for all my life, which was adding density to existing neighborhoods to enhance affordability, wasn't working. So in conclusion, the pandemic came around. I, like everybody else, was kind of stuck on my couch for a long time, and pretty frustrated with what was going on with the pandemic. And of course, noticing, like many others, that the people who are the hardest hit by the pandemic were people in low-wage jobs, people who stock your grocery shelves, who drive the Uber, who deliver your Uber Eats, who clean the bedpans at the hospitals, the hospital orderlies. Basically, people who get low wages also tend to be people who are in contact with other people a lot. And they also tend to be in our area and many other areas, people who have to commute a very long distance to their jobs because they can't afford to rent any place within an hour commute. So they're you know, they're traveling all day long and in some cases exposed to the, spreading the pandemic during their commutes, but more importantly, sort of in contact with people in large numbers as part of what we call our frontline workers. And then spreading, as it turns out, if you really study the statistics, spreading the diseases into their homes, because they tend to have more, that cohort tend to have more people sharing bedrooms and so forth. 12 to a three-room apartment is quite common, particularly in the United States communities. So if you add all that, I'm from the United States, as you mentioned. If you add all that to the race issue, where people who are Black and brown in the United States only on average have 1/10 of the wealth as white people like myself. And if you really scratch at that, it's not money in the bank we're talking about. It's that Black people don't own homes. And because they don't own homes, they live in those crowded neighborhoods that add that much danger. So in the United States, the death rates for Black and brown people was, you know, between 4 and 10 times higher than if you were lucky enough to be white and live in a largely white community. So in scratching around trying to say, what the heck can you do about that? What you discover, and what related to what I'm talking about, is the fact that it's not so much the house that costs a lot. Houses don't cost that much. It's the land, it's the dirt under the house that costs a lot. And when you add density, it just increases the cost of the land and adds to the wealth of the 1%. And in particular, those members of the 1% who are in the business of land speculation. And we have that in spades here in Vancouver. I'll stop there and give you a chance to question.
Definitely. You know, it's pretty interesting, like the connection you made between a lot of these issues. And, you know, one thing that your book really talks about is the land value aspect of things, which is definitely interesting, because I see a lot of days, you know, there are headlines in Vancouver. It's like, oh, you know, this rundown house selling for like $2 million. But, you know, in essence, it's not really the house that's selling for $2 million. It's the land underneath the house that is selling for that amount. And, you know, how do you believe that it's the issue of like land value is directly linked to some of the issues that we're seeing nowadays in regards to inequality and housing affordability?
Yeah, I mean, it's not immediately obvious. And, you know, it wasn't immediately obvious to me, and I've been working in this field for 40 years now. So it wasn't immediately obvious that the problem really was the price of land until relatively recently for me. So it's no surprise that people don't see that right away. But the story that I tell, or the explanation that I think helps explain it, why it's important, is that this problem of urban land price is not a new problem. The problem of urban land price showed up most recently historically in North America during the period that they call the Gilded Era. That's when the Rockefellers and all those super rich people, you know, like the Vanderbilts and all that stuff, the Carnegies, they basically ended up owning almost everything. And the real thing that they owned was land. You know, some of them were called railroad barons, but what they really, the railroad was a vehicle to owning most of the land within 4 miles of the tracks. So during that period, when all that wealth was going towards those wealthy people, a fellow showed up in, he actually spent some time in BC working as a journalist in Victoria. And then he went to San Francisco and worked as a journalist down there. His name was Henry George. And Henry George became really quite famous as a self-taught economist. And during his life, he was more famous than Mark Twain. He was more famous than for economics than Karl Marx, for example, which we've probably found, we would find astonishing now And he wrote a book called Progress and Poverty in the late 1880s, 1887, I think. He had to publish it himself because no publisher would touch it. An interesting part of the story is that eventually that book became so famous that it was translated into 27 languages, sold around the world. And for the following 10 years, his book outsold the Bible. More copies of it were sold than the Christian Bible in North America. And the story gets even more interesting because he ends up in New York and he runs for mayor and he almost wins. And he would have won if the Tammany Hall, the corrupt actors in Tammany Hall didn't fix the voting. He came in second and he beat Teddy Roosevelt, who eventually became president of the United States, who was also in that race, who came in third. Now, why did he get so famous? Huh? That's what's going through your mind now. He got so famous because he came up with a very simple analysis of the problem we're talking about today, which is land price. Unlike any economist before, and for the most part, any economist since, he said the problem is when you get a city and a city starts to grow, and he compared New York and San Francisco in this. He says, why is it that in New York, when I go to New York, there's poor people in the streets, there's homeless, there's beggars, and there's so much wealth that's obvious there. But when I come back to San Francisco, which was a new city in the late 1880s, everybody has a job, everybody has a place to sleep. We're obviously not as rich as in New York. So in trying to figure out the answer to that question, they were both, capitalist cities in the same country. So it should have been a similar situation, you would think. His diagnosis was that as a city matures, the effort of the workers and the capitalists, basically the owners of capital, whether that's a cappuccino shop or a hat factory, the entrepreneurial class and the wage earning class, both of their efforts end up being absorbed. Almost all the value of that becomes absorbed in the value of the land that they both have to either work on or do their business on, that all of that effort ends up going just into the pockets of the landowner. And furthermore, he said, it gets to the point inevitably and mechanically that so much of that value gets put into the value of land. Everybody is struggling so hard that the whole system is always on the verge of collapse. And that's why he said you get these cyclical economic collapses. The most recent in the United States anyways was in 2008, when yet again, urban land value inflated way out of sight, and it endangered the whole system in various ways. And the global economy was brought to a sneeze and only bailed out because central banks flooded the system with trillions of dollars back in those days. So. Coming to the end of this Henry George story, he said what you ought to do in this circumstance is not tax income, not tax capital, which would be business profits, but just tax urban land. And you would get enough money that way, and it will drive down the price of that land so that it would not be attractive to land speculators anymore, so that the economy could run appropriately and freely of the drag of land price. Now we are seeing that in Vancouver. We have a crushing burden here of people not being able to get access to housing in the city that their job is, in the city where they should be able to get access to housing. We have business owners who can't get workers to work at a wage that's reasonable because no one can afford to live here. The city is being pressed to the breaking point here in a way that Henry George described. So in my book, I kind of revive, I'm not the only one doing this these days, because the problem is just like in the so-called Gilded Era, excuse me. So I'm one of the people who's talking about this, and there's various prescriptions for what to do about it. The one that's described in my book is basically, you can tax land generally, and some places do that. The other way to do it that makes a lot of sense in Vancouver is just to tax development. all these new high-rise condos that are going up that are selling for fantastic prices, like $4,000 a square foot in some cases for Vancouver House, by Ian Gillespie down at the end of the Granville Bridge, basically tax the development and tax it at a level that the increase in its value is taxed at the same level as you're taxing it. So that money that you gain, which is in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, could be shifted away from land speculators' pockets into affordable non-market housing, which, you know, presumably students at UBC could afford.
Great, that's interesting to hear. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus. My name is Alarat, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Professor Patrick Condon. So far, we've talked a bit about the issue going on globally, and especially in Vancouver, of high housing costs. In relation to Professor Condon's recent book, Sick City, we also discussed how the issue of poor quality housing is associated with the spread of coronavirus, and how the issue is essentially rooted in the practice of land speculation. So going on, Gurman, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of upzoning, bringing up rental prices, sort of goes against the idea of supply and demand that I was taught in high school. And I was just wondering, how exactly would you reconcile those two together?
I would reconcile those two together by not reconciling those two together. In my view, supply and demand does not apply to the housing market for the reasons that I've described. And the real reason is that urban land, although it's hard to get your head around this, is actually a monopoly. You know, they don't make more of it. So the amount of urban land within an urban setting is a fixed commodity. You can add housing, but for reasons that I've described, it doesn't help as much as you would hope it would help, or at all, because as you add density, the value of the land just goes up. The market value of the land goes up in parallel with it. So it's not like tomatoes. If you have a bumper crop of tomatoes, you know, you can get them at the market for a whole lot less because they have to move them that week. That tomatoes are produced and sold in conformance with the laws of supply and demand, but housing is not. And you know, I see the confused look on your face on Zoom, and I don't expect you to believe this because it took me 20 years to come to the conclusion that supply and demand in this case doesn't work.
But in a way, you know, for example, think about it, like when we're thinking about it, you know, so supply and demand wouldn't apply to land per se, but would it still apply to housing? Because it's still, while you can't create more land, you can create more, say, like apartment buildings.
That's why the point that I'm making is so crucial to this argument. And I am definitely in a minority still. Most people, you know, who teach at UBC, like me, will say, you know, we're just not supplying enough housing. And if we supplied more housing, the price would go down. Because microeconomics 101 says that's the rule, and that will definitely happen no matter what. But the point I keep emphasizing, I mentioned it a couple of times already in this conversation, is when you add allowable density, which the city governs how much density can be on a parcel through policies. Under present circumstances, zoning, when it's relaxed, when you say we have a housing crisis, so on this parcel, we're going to say instead of a two-story building, you can have a 20-story building in the hopes that those apartments would become cheaper. the result is, and we don't see any evidence at all of cheapening housing as a consequence of adding to supply in the city of Vancouver, that's for sure. When you add that additional layer of housing, when you stack housing on top of that parcel, what happens is the value of that land goes up. And the reason why, the other way to think about this is that if you were able to get that land at a cheap price, and suddenly you, instead of like one story building, you could put a 20 story building on it. Do you think you would sell those units for lower than the market value of those units as condos? The answer is no, you wouldn't. No entrepreneur will do that, nor should they. So even if they got the land for a bargain price, they wouldn't be selling the units. Now, when I say this, this is to help us all get our head around the idea that the value of housing in the city of Vancouver is a function of the value of the built unit, not how many units you get on that land. And it's the global appetite for the units in our city that sets the price. The global price for our new dwelling units, no matter where it is in the city generally, is about between $1,200 and $2,000 a square foot, no matter what kind of house it is, whether it's a single family home or a downtown tower or something in between. That's the global market value of our product. And when you can get more product on a piece of land, it doesn't decrease the global value of that unit. It elevates the land. Now, there are people who argue with me that said, if you only unleashed all that capacity, if you just threw zoning out the window and let everybody build whatever density they wanted, you would so overwhelm the system with supply that, you know, you would, that prices would have to drop. And I get that. That makes a lot of logical sense. But empirically, when you look at what's happened in the city of Vancouver over the period since the 1980s, when we started adding density to the downtown, we went from a downtown density of under 40,000 people, which translates into 20,000 dwelling units, to a current population, which is approaching 90,000 people, which is, a you know, 50,000 dwelling units. So it's basically a doubling of the dwelling units. Did prices go down since the 1980s to now?
No.
They did not. After that, we went and we rezoned all the arterial streets. We let 4 and 5 and 6, now 6-story buildings be built along the arterial streets. It's a condominium choice that you can buy in that market. Did prices go down?
No,
they did not. We legalized within just the past 15 years, secondary suites throughout the city so that they're legal anywhere in the city. Did that make prices go down? That was an additional potential for 70,000 additional units. Did rents go down?
Nope.
And finally, we have just recently decided that so-called single-family neighborhoods, the truth is they're not single-family anymore. Now you're legally authorized to have 4 dwelling units on any single-family lot because they've legally duplexed every lot, and every half duplex can also have a rental suite. And, you know, that's relatively recently, but I suspect that prices will not go down. We have, in fact, in Vancouver, flooded the market with additional market capacity for new units. And if the laws of supply and demand were actually laws, we should have seen softening. And you might argue that, well, it would have been a lot worse if we hadn't done those things. That's a reasonable argument as well. Then how do you explain, it would have been unbelievably, incredibly expensive in the absence, if you follow that logic, it would have been incredibly expensive. But as I mentioned at the beginning, our housing is almost as expensive as any place in the world. So, you know, I can't imagine how it would get worse.
That's an interesting point there. We'll be right back on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
A
According to the BC Centre for Disease Control, symptoms of coronavirus disease 2019, or COVID-19, may develop after 2 to 14 days of exposure. Common symptoms are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. Call your doctor if you are experiencing these symptoms. Emergency signs of COVID-19 are difficulty breathing or shortness of breath, persistent pain or pressure in chest, new confusion or inability to arouse, and bluish lips or face. This is not an exhaustive list. Go to the emergency room if you are experiencing these symptoms.
We're back here on Research Review. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. So in the past bit, we've been talking with our guest today, Professor Condon, a bit about how the principle of supply and demand is not behind the issue of housing unaffordability. Now, going back to that, I was wondering, because one thing you mentioned, for example, for supply and demand, it would apply. So you mentioned that it wouldn't apply to land values, but how about just rent? If you create more units.
I know. It would be great if that didn't happen. If you're depending on the market for what's happening in Vancouver, okay, let's talk about rents for a minute. If you're depending on the market in Vancouver to generate rental units, the rental units have to compete with the condo units for the value of that real estate. Because, you know, if you're going to build a, rental building instead of a condo building, you want it to make at least as much money as the condo building. And under present circumstances, in order for the rental building to generate as much money, and by that, you have to remember that, when you're figuring out that deal, you have to say, I can afford X amount for that land. And the condo developer is saying, I can afford Y amount for that land. Rental developer X has to be able to spend as much for that land as condo developer Y for that land. And after you do all the numbers and you look at your deal, you say, I have to rent this place out at roughly twice the current market rents. Otherwise, my deal won't work. It's entirely because that new rental building has to compete with the new condo building. And it's the global market for the condo space that does that. Now, the city has been successful in getting more rental buildings than they have in the past. There was hardly any built between 1985 when they first allowed condominiums. They weren't legal prior to 1985. Between 1985 and roughly 2005 to 10 in that area, there was almost no new rental buildings built. And the city, hoping to do something about this long-term housing crisis, started to do things that would provide certain advantages to rental building construction. So they forego taxes on rental buildings, they give them additional density, they do additional stuff to make it work. But that's just around the edges, because when the project is rented out, it's usually, it's often twice the cost per square foot. And that's why you see a preponderance of very small units, so that they can sort of disguise that fact that it's twice as much per square foot. But that's how they have to do the deal. I don't blame them, because that's the only way they can make the numbers work. And it only rents out to the people who are making above $120,000 a year, which ends up being the top 10% of wage earners. I have to go so far as to say that there's been a lot of press, and I've had a lot of articles about this, about a city incentive, which is called the Moderate Income Rental Housing Pilot Project, where they've authorized 10 very large buildings. And in return, they've demanded that of that giant building, 20% of the units had to be for people making less than $80,000, which is, the average, my graduates who are professionals getting out of with master's degrees at UBC, they start off in the $45,000 to $50,000 range. So even they can't afford the so-called affordable ones, unless they're married and they combine incomes and those kinds of things. So you get 20% affordable and 80% that are only affordable to the top 10%, even with a lot of taxpayer subsidies. I'm giving you more detail than you need on this one, just to try to explain how rental ends up being the victim of the overall real estate market dominated by the value of condominiums.
And, you know, one other issue that we see overall is this is the disparity between basically land and real estate values and wages. We've seen this in increasing years where now when you compare real estate values to wages, the growth, it's a chart that kind of looks like the magnitude of difference between them is ever increasing. And if do you think it's possible that this increase could continue indefinitely into the future? What do you think would be really the tipping point? What would be the ceiling?
Well, I think we're getting pretty close to the tipping point already. And you see that as political pressures build up globally. You know, you see it in the evidence of like the voters reacting with huge frustration and electing a guy like Trump. You know, populist movements around the world. I mean, increasing inequality as an issue and blaming immigrants for your problems. I mean, there's all kinds of political things that are happening now that it's reasonable to say are a consequence of that increasing disparity between the value of labor and the amount of capital that's flowing away from wage earners. So the chart that you're referring to, your listeners can't see it, but basically what it shows is that up until the 1970s, when there was a productivity increase, when wage earners were, because they're using machinery or whatever, because they're smarter, when they were producing more value every hour, they would get their share of that value and the owner would get their share and the split was more or less equal. But after the 1970s, productivity doubled, but wages stayed after inflation, after adjusting for inflation, stayed relatively flat. So the big gap between wages and what went to wages and what went to owners became bigger and bigger. And by owners, we're talking about people who actually own factories, but also people who own stocks and bonds, retirement funds, you know, all those entities. So it's complicated. I mean, middle-class people sometimes are getting taking advantage of this because they're on the income stream that comes from capital, going to capital. You know, 95% of it is going to the 1% or the top 2%. And that is exacerbating the kind of problems that we have. This does get back to the Henry George theorem. And you want to remember that he operated within the world of the land barons, and it was similar in his day. You know, in the places he was examining, nobody could afford to rent an apartment. They were living on the street or they were couch surfing, or, you know, the recent immigrants were like 5 to a bedroom in Brooklyn and all this kind of stuff in a situation that was very much akin to ours. And yet, even though there was obvious need, most of the money was going to the moneyed classes. His suggestion is that there's a mechanical, that this is the way capitalism simply operates unless you intervene and do something about it. What disguised that for people in my generation, when I was born right at the end of World War II, if you read a book by Thomas Piketty called Capital in the 21st Century, he does a wonderful job of describing what he shows as using data had happened. His hypothesis, which kind of marries in with what Henry George was talking about, was prior to World War II, it was the same situation. The poor were very poor. The rich were very rich. There really wasn't much of a middle class. And we're moving back towards that situation now with a shrinking middle class, an increasing our wealthy class, and a vastly increasing people making precarious wages. Call them poor if you will, but they still own a trailer and a pickup truck. You know, it's a new middle class kind of poverty. You know, they don't the average American, for example, 50% of Americans don't have enough money, cash resources, that a $300 unexpected bill would make them broke. Anyway, I'm going too far sideways on this. I want to get back to what Piketty said, and I'll conclude with that. He said that First World War One, and then the Depression, and then World War Two interrupted this natural flow of capital into the hands of the wealthy, obviously, particularly in Europe, which was devastated. And the, as a consequence of that destruction of that value, stocks took a hit, bonds took a hit. There was huge inflation that took the value away from people who had money in the bank. So if you look at the charts, the wealth of the top 5% after World War II radically shrinks, whereas the wealth, mostly housing wealth, of the middle class dramatically increases until 1980 or so, 75-80. And then it starts to shrink back, then it starts to split off again with the middle class wealth shrinking and upper class wealth increasing. And we're coming back to a point in history that those gaps are tremendous. And anybody who has money can make money by, to bring it back to the housing question in Vancouver, the best way to make money is to buy condominiums, young man. If you can find money to put into condominiums, you should definitely invest, because right now it's the safest thing to do. Even though they cost $1.5 million, this simply is not a safer investment for you to make, because you can be guaranteed at least a 6% value increase every year into the infinite future, unless we have a giant bubble collapse. But, you know, I've been waiting for the Vancouver bubble to collapse for the last 30 years, and it hasn't yet. I know that was discursive, but that's an attempt to try to explain how wages can go so far away from home costs. And the answer is it's happened before.
Yeah, hope it doesn't happen again. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my co-host Grimond, today we are interviewing Professor Patrick Condon. In the past few minutes, we've talked about the disparity between land values and wages and how this reflects the situation prior to World War II, where the poor were very poor and the rich were very rich. Now, Grimond, you had a question for our guest, I believe.
And in your book, you use Vienna as a model for how modern-day cities could work. So maybe could you elaborate a bit more on how the Vienna model could work in Vancouver, per se?
Yeah, the Vienna model is really interesting. I'll start this answer this question again with Henry George. He basically says tax the land, but there's a million ways to do that. So in Vienna, to mitigate the strength of the landowner classes, the landlords in Vienna, the landlords owned all the housing. It was all rental housing for the most part, unless you were rich and you had a mansion. So the landlords had infinite power at the end of World War One, and they were the only ones who were allowed to vote, even though they were only 5% of the population. So when the Habsburg Empire collapsed, there was huge political changes. Can't go into the details right now, it'd take too long, but at the end of a few years of chaos, everybody could vote, you know, no matter if you had no money, you get to vote. So there was, women could vote, and it was universal suffrage. So for the period before World War II, a socialist government came in. And what they did, some socialist governments during that interwar period nationalized stuff, including how, you know, the Marxists, obviously, in Soviet Union, nationalized all housing. So they kicked out anybody who was in there, and they put in anybody they felt like putting in. They didn't do that in Vienna. They had a more moderate view. They simply taxed property at a very high rate. And that did a couple things. One, it generated a lot of money, and they put all of that money into housing for people of modest means, what I call generally non-market housing. That can be co-op housing, it can be social housing, it can be rental housing managed by nonprofit corporations and stuff like that. They basically granted a lot of that money to those entities, and there's a very wide variety of those kinds of housing entities that were spawned then. And the other thing that high tax on the landlords did was it reduced the price of urban land, right? Because the taxes were so high on the so-called building. Really what happened was, in the same way that I've been talking about, the real value is in the dirt. So they put a tax burden on the building, but the result was the land ended up citywide getting cheaper. So they took a lot of that tax money and used it to buy land, which was suddenly way more affordable. So they could buy four times more land with $1 million than they would 5 years ago. See, their taxing strategy depressed the land value. They took the tax, bought land, gave the land to nonprofit entities to build housing. So, of course, it got interrupted in World War II when the Nazis took over. So it only lasted till, you know, like 1936 or 7 or something like that. But then after World War II, they picked it up again. And now 55% of all the housing in the city is non-market housing, which is, if I could show you a website. If you plan to move to Vienna, the first thing you need to do is go on this website, and it says, where would you like to live? And you just put your name in it, and virtually anybody can get a non-market housing unit at an affordable price. And they don't income qualify you. They don't say, well, you have to make less than 80,000 in order to get it, because they have so much of this housing. They don't have to do that. And there's so much of this non-market housing available that it actually depresses, still to this day, the rents and the home prices for market housing. They have a market housing industry there. They build new condos in Vienna, but they cost about a quarter of what they cost in a similar European city, like say Rome or Paris or something like that. Because still to this day, the land value underneath that market project, because of the strength of the non-market sector, is much lower than the equivalent parcel in Berlin or in Milan or in Paris, where they have similar problems of land value inflation to our own. Do you follow? Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, just one last question, because, you know, we've been, you know, Gurman mentioned the Vienna example, which you went in through your book. And, you know, so far we've also been talking a lot about the house values in Vancouver, the problems that we have here. But most importantly, the focus of your book was on the United States, is pretty much what you focused on, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, one question I just have is that, you know, because when you look at what's going on in the United States and a lot of U.S. cities, there are a lot of parallels that you see to Canada, Vancouver, other parts of the world as well. In some ways, you know, I would say that the housing and affordability inequality problem in Vancouver could be in some ways worse than some U.S. cities. But really comparing these two, because, you know, you've done a lot of work on the United States, you've done a lot of work in Canada as well. When comparing the issues in U.S. and Canada, what are the differences you see? Like, what is worse, what is better in Canada, for example, in Vancouver?
To start with, the structural problem of real estate value is worse here than in most of the United States. There are certain critical cities, and you can think of them as global cities. In Canada, it's basically Toronto and Vancouver that qualify as global cities, where the prices are influenced by the global appetite for real estate as a commodity. In the United States, you look at a number of metropolitan areas like Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles. You can kind of count them on your hand, one hand, but, you know, a relatively similar number of global cities where they have the same problem that we have. Where they're not as bad as us is that their salaries in those locations tend to be better than ours. Our salaries for an equal occupation, equal level of education are probably 30 to 40% in real dollar terms, less than what you would be making in a San Francisco. And yet the housing prices are more. So that's what makes ours worse. What makes ours not as bad is Canada doesn't have 400 years of impediments in the way of acquisition of real estate wealth that have been experienced by American blacks as a consequence of slavery. And I do have a big chunk in my book about that, which talks about what happened after slavery and how blacks were prevented from getting access to land wealth. To this day, it's still persisting. So that absence of access to land wealth has impeded a lot of their capacities and opportunities to advance themselves to levels anything like what white guys like me were able to do. Because, you know, I didn't realize I was privileged, you know, until I really looked at this, until I really started to look at this data and realized, yeah, my dad had money and he had money because my grandfather had money and my grandfather had money because he owned a factory. You know, there was all this stuff that's still a legacy for Americans, and particularly damaging to blacks, because up until the 1970s and 80s and still to this day in various ways, but there were literal prohibitions on blacks acquiring real estate wealth up until relatively recently. So that's not been overcome. So that's the biggest difference. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing and people getting killed in the street in the United States is a legacy of that horror that, unfortunately for us in Canada, we don't have. But what we do have is for people in your generation having a much, much harder time than you ought to have in terms of having a less than precarious existence. Even people with college degrees now, you know, are confronted with a lot of very difficult choices that my generation didn't have to face.
Definitely.
Yeah. We are running out of time here, but I would love to thank you for enlightening us a bit more on how Vancouver's housing crisis really does work. And it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to such bright and intelligent young man. So keep up the good work.
Definitely.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. Yeah.
We really appreciate having you on our show. This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Today's host was Professor Patrick Condon, and if you're wondering, his recent book is called Sick City, so if you want to read more, just Google that. We hope you listen to our next episode, and have a nice day.